Let's just agree to disagree, my friend.
Yes, and welcome back, everybody, to the Talking Split podcast. I am Rob Coulter, as always, joined by Vic Metro Means Darren Best. Welcome, Bestie.
Good morning, everyone. Or good evening. Depends on when you're listening.
Oh, a little bit smart. I like that. You've done very well there. Probably evenings for most people, I'd probably suggest, actually, is probably more accurate. Zoe Carr, welcome from the Vic Country Women.
Thank you for having me.
Fantastic to have you both in. Just a reminder, you can follow along on the at Talking Split social media platforms on Instagram and X. You have both come off what has been a fairly busy weekend, as Zoe literally yawns as I'm going through this. So I'll go to you first, Bestie. Country Metro Challenge over the weekend. What is it? How did it go?
So it's a Basketball Victoria High Performance Program Initiative. This was the second year we've ran it. We have our future development programs, both Metro and Country. Basically, we pick some kids to come together in Bendigo. We have a few practices and then we play some games. You know, there's no ladder positions or anything like that. You know, we actually move some kids around depending on what's needed. It's just a great development event for us in the under-14s. And for us as high-performance coaches, it's a chance for us to see the kids, you know, come together from their hubs and compete and get in our style of play, system of play, all of that. We actually started with a camp on the Saturday. So we had a pre-departure or prep camp, if you want to call it that, in Melbourne. So we did a few hours and then obviously practiced each morning while we're up there Sunday, Monday, and they all played four games. So really good, really good.
And really the first touch point you've had with those kids since Southern Cross Challenge in, what, January? So it's been probably 6 months since you've seen those kids all come together again.
Yeah, oh well, we had a selection camp for this before the prep camp, so we got to see them then. But yeah, mostly when we go out, we see them in small numbers in the hubs.
Yep. How'd it go from the women's side? Sorry?
Yeah, really good. High level of understanding, high level of willingness to change, because a lot of the time we're asking them to do things that they've either, you know, they're not regularly doing either at their clubs or at their school. And their willingness to actually give it a go. So from a girl's perspective or country girl's perspective, the willingness to shoot the three at the end of a split kick extra action, they don't want to do that because at that age they're not really consistent three-point shooters. But their willingness to let it fly was great. So being able to have them, you know, for 2 days in an environment where we could really make some difference, make some change, was really exciting. And for us, it's always great to be able to go up against Metro and have the level and the tempo and the physicality be able to, you know, see what that's like and get a chance to see that and experience that before hitting under 16s and nationals and things. So, yeah, a really great day and or 2 days and really exciting. And, you know, we also saw a lot of referee development as well. We had our referees there and I think three of our referee staff from here were doing ref coaching as well. And it was what was really cool about that was we asked for a different style of reffing to what they're used to. So, you know, if hands are in, yes, call it. But if anything through the chest, any body contact, let it go. And it took a bit of time for the athletes to adjust to that, but it was, you saw then starting to become a little bit more comfortable with physicality and things like that. So yeah, overall, all round, it was just a really exciting and beneficial 2 days.
If you were talking to people in that under 14 age group as coaches at the moment, what are maybe a couple of things that you'd really emphasise they work on with their kids based on what you saw on the weekend?
So for the girls, being able, the ability to stay in front of the ball in both in the full and half court. So we have rules of pin in D-trans, pin the ball to the sideline, And they were trying to do that, and that was great, but it was almost like a willingness to just ride the hip and allow them to then turn the corner, and now we're in disadvantage. So being able to keep the ball in front, similarly on in, out of rotations or even just in the half court, just not allowing, not opening the gate and allowing people to straight line drives. From an offensive perspective, I would say probably spacing, keeping space. And day two spacing was much better than day one, and that's where being able to have them for an extended period of time over the 2 days where you see those sort of improvements. But being comfortable living in space, not converging on the ball when the ball's picked up was a really big one. And again, yeah, if it gets to you and your feet are outside the three-point line and you're wide open, shoot the ball. We've got to let them do it.
Yep. What about on the men's side, Bestie?
Definitely D-trains. You know, so we practiced it on the Saturday, we practiced it on the Sunday, and then after the first round of games, we practiced it again on the Monday, right?
So just out of curiosity, only because it came in on a tweet I saw during the week, what were your D-trains rules on this one? Like, someone was asking about, it was Coach Funds, I think it was, on Twitter. Like, what are the D-trains rules you're teaching at the moment?
Yeah, we've tried to keep it simple because we've got to budget our time, right? So point guard, get to the nail. Five-man, go rebound if you can. Everybody else, you're back. And then it's, you know, order of priority, ball, basket, plug, deny the kick ahead.
Yep.
That's pretty much it.
Yep. Did you find it was foreign to a lot of the kids?
A lot of buddy running, you know. So if I'm guarding the ball and it's kicked ahead, I just sort of stay in line with my player. So we had to really drill that at practice. On the kick ahead, you got to sprint below the line of the ball, effectively build a wall, you know, and make him throw backwards or lateral passes. So that, and just to be honest, just caring about it, you know, like I had to say to the group, like, you guys don't care about this, you know, as players, you know. And we were trying to do some disruption stuff up the court, you know, face guarding their point guard and stuff like that. But their understanding of shot clock, so we had a normal shot clock, so it didn't start at halfway, it started on the first possession. So we'll get to the offense in a second, but defensively understanding, you know, when it starts at halfway, kids are more likely, I think, to play gambling defense because no one wants to play defense for that long. It's just the reality of it. You know, when I, you know, way back when I played college, it was a 35-second shot clock and a 35-second reset. So you give up an O-board, you're playing, you know,
over a minute
70 straight, seconds of defense, you know, you better be in a stance, you know, so no one wants to do that. So I think having the shot clock the way it is actually leads to a lot of gambling on defense because they want to do it. So we changed that and we slowly managed to get them to understand that D-trans is more about containment and stealing shot clock seconds. That's the way we described it to the boys. You know, we're trying to steal shot clock seconds. You know, so that got better as the event went on. But then on the other side of it, just getting organized quickly on offense because obviously the other teams were trying to steal shot clock seconds as well. So then we would end up like normal basketball, to be honest. If it's not a layup, you know, or a kick out three in transition scored in that first, you know, 6 to 8 seconds and the ball is picked up, most of the time you've got, you know, 16, 15, 14 seconds to run whatever it is you're running in the half court. So getting organized quickly after our prep day, the first session, I spoke to our coaches about just using the word shape, and we then explained to the players before the second session that when we are calling shape out, that that's what we mean. We've got to find some shape because sometimes in transition you might get a bit distorted or whatever, and how are you going to rescue the possession to then get back to whatever our concepts were? And, you know, we just simplified it. We've got a two-side and we've got a three-side, you know, so find some shape. And it got better, and our coaches were doing a good job just simplifying the language, calling that out. It got better as the weekend went on, you know. So for us, we had 3 hours of practice on the Saturday, an hour on the Sunday, an hour on the Monday, and then 4 games, and it was uninterrupted. So what I mean by that is, you know, there was no one else coming to, I guess, poison the punch. You know, like we had them in a silo, basically, you know, like the only basketball they were getting, apart from parents, I guess, if there was some of that, but instruction, coaching instruction was from us. And it was a huge improvement. Like it was the, I would say that game three, so the first game on day two for me across the board was the best. Yeah. Because we'd had some practices, you know, all of that type of stuff. Game four, you could see some fatigue starting to kick in, like, you know, because they're young. But it was really pleasing to see. It looked like basketball. And really, really proud of our coaches for doing that. Yep. You know.
Oh, awesome. Sounds like a great event more than anything else. Like, it's always fun to see the next generation of kids come through. And, you know, obviously you haven't seen a lot of these kids other than the occasional FDP session when you're able to get to them and those types of things. It's just nice to bring them back in and sort of find out where they're at and what they're doing and what the emphasis needs to be for this group as they move into eventually SDP for those that are fortunate enough to do it. So it's a great touch point more than anything else that we probably haven't had before, in all honesty. All right, under 17 men are currently playing the Crocs. They're over in Turkey at the moment. 2-0 at this time of recording. Got Canada coming up, I want to say, without any confidence at all, but you're both nodding at me, so I'm going to assume that's the way we're going. Have you caught games? What do you like? Those types of things. What are your initial thoughts on that, Zoe?
Yes, watched both games. What was really cool at CMC was Bestie had organised with Bendigo to get a TV in the bistro when we were having our coaches' dinner. And when he said, oh, a TV's coming, we thought, oh, just, you know, the one they used to wheel out in high school when it was the last week of term and you'd watch a video, like the... No, it was like 85-inch massive thing that it was awesome. And so it was really cool to be able to sit there together as coaches and watch. But it's World Cups, any type of international tournaments are tough and it doesn't matter who you play. You know, you could come up against a team you think you should beat. Nobody is an easy beat. And one thing that's great for the Crocs at the moment is they've had they've been pushed a couple of times and they're only getting better in each game, and they're going to need to get better to play Canada because Canada are pretty sharp. So that'll be a really exciting game to watch. The way they're pushing the ball, the thing I've really enjoyed, and we made some comments about it while we were watching, was in transition their willingness to kick opposite and then let the three fly. Hasn't always been successful, but it's they're constantly putting pressure on the D-trans of the opposition, and it's something that eventually wears teams down. So, you know, Mading has been unbelievable, his impact in the game. So same with Beecham has been amazing. So two Victorians, very exciting. But their impact on the game and their ability to step up right in the clutch has been huge. So if any athletes are listening to this, try and go back and watch those games and watch what it was they did. And they didn't try and take over as such and you know, go head down, butt up and do everything on their own. But they took what came to them and then obviously took control and finished off possessions when they needed to. So it's a skill and it's something worth having a look at, I think.
Yep. What about you, Bestie? What were your thoughts on seeing their first two, especially given you've just come from Schweizer, like the difference in level between the two tournaments and those types of things?
Yeah, well, we actually played that U17 Germany team in a practice game before Schweizer. So, you know, it was interesting to see some of those kids. And obviously they were doing things in their own age group that they weren't able to do against the Emus, you know, because they're older, bigger, stronger. But just without talking about X's and O's and all of this, just it's awesome. You know, like we've got 8 Victorians in the 12, you know. So from a program standpoint, we're super happy with that. We've got 2 Victorians in the coaching staff. Like, unbelievable.
Oh, we're reclaiming Asher.
Right.
He's Vic.
You know, but the good thing about it is, you know, it's kind of like that Bluey episode, you know, with the Maroons and the, yes, you know, and then like we come together and we're all, you know, for Australia. So that is unbelievable, you know, just to see Australia do well. And I'm sure we'll get to the Gems in a second, because as soon as that game was over, we then put the Gems game on. So to see that, you know, and the next morning I actually asked some of the kids. I was like, you know, who watched the games? And a couple of kids put their hands up and I was like, right, I'm going to, you know, and then I was like, who'd they play? You know, and then they're like, oh, no, they, you know, they played Germany. I'm like, okay. So then I doubled down. I'm like, what did you notice? And like, it was obvious that they'd watched it, yep. You know, so that was cool. And
Next you're just trying to ruin kids' days early. Well, I'm double checking on this.
You're lying? You're on the line. Yeah. That was cool. And, you know, they could see some connection with what we were doing. Even the coaches were saying the same thing. And it was – even as the games were going on, I was getting some text messages from other coaches that were watching it. And it's just, you know, it's cool. And it's a really cool time at the moment. Like we said before the pod started, we've got, you know, Gems and Crocs. And then now we've got Boomers and Opals. And it's, you know, and then shortly, you know, the 17s, Women's. Sapphires, right? They'll be going to their World Cup, and then the Emus will be going to Asia Cup. It's just, you know, and
Olympics coming up.
Olympics, 16 nationals next week. It's, you know, it's unreal. It's unreal. So really happy for them. You know, they got tested against Egypt, you know, and then they, you know, they were down against Germany, and it was, you know, it was tough.
That's the bit I've kind of liked the most is that they found a way to have a lead against Egypt. And had to fight off a rampaging Egypt down the stretch. But they also got behind against Germany and found a way to rally back. So they've been tested two different ways, which is just so valuable once you get into tournament play to have experienced that beforehand. Because you never really know what your tournament prep's going to look like. We all know you don't get a heap of time with your team before you go to tournaments. And then you sort of hope to get a Four Nations in or whatever it might look like there. But I think that it really holds them in good stead. And you mentioned it before, Zoe. This is a great test for them now. And... I'm always a little hesitant to name players, especially under the age of 18, but how much fun has it been watching Harry Beauchamp? Like, the kid just wins.
He does it all the time. Yeah. You know, like, it's kind of, you know, every three...
It's not boring yet, thankfully. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, three, keep going.
Three gold medal games in a national championship for us, for Vic Metro. He's been the man, you know, and he's had great gold medal games. He did it in Oceania. He did it, you know, in Asia, and now he's, you know, that fourth quarter against Egypt, he was cooking, and he did it again. Now, the good thing is they'll adjust. The other teams will adjust, and they'll know that he's and where he is good is he will just continue to make the right play. He's not the type of guy to force it. But from a coaching perspective, I feel like we sort of spoke about it a little bit as a fan perspective.
Yeah.
But from a coaching perspective, I was really. You know, happy for the coaching group. You know, they changed their rotations in that game against Germany because, you know, there were some matchup problems, there were some fouling issues, you know, and they changed some things and perhaps some guys that will feature heavily and had featured heavily through Asia, like in that game, that wasn't their game. And it's kudos to the coaching group to make those changes in it because it clearly worked.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fantastic. And even, all right, so we'll jump over to the Gems now who qualified – for the World Cup, had already qualified before the final on Saturday night, but coming up against a fairly unique Chinese team, it'd be fair to say. Talk us through what you saw on that one, Zoe.
It would be so intimidating coming up against, especially for female athletes, to come up against a 7'2" athlete. It's not something that you see... ever, really. So,
especially one that's got pretty good touch.
She can move.
Like she's okay.
Yep, yeah. She can move. She's got good touch. And they use her well. They don't try and make her do things outside of her skill set or anything like that. They get her feet in the paint, they get her the ball, and they get out of the way.
Yeah, on that like, right block.
Yeah, yep. Like it is. Now, what I thought the Germans did an outstanding job of, you know, there's not much you can do against that unless you've got something size-wise sort of to match it. So they just bodied up as best they could, made it as hard as possible and gassed her. Like they made it so she was exhausted. And they, as soon as we came up with it, whether it be off their score or they came up with a rebound, they were gone. The bigs ran and you could see that it was a directive. And, you know, you sort of... I think sometimes we watch international tournaments like we should be winning games by this much or we should be up by this much and we should not be doing anything. We should be playing the game in front of us and seeing how it rolls. You know, there's having that sort of expectation, I think, is just ridiculous. But all they did was keep it close as they could, or obviously be ahead. So the lead sort of chopped and changed, but kept it close, knowing that towards the end of the game, she was going to be exhausted and her efficiency would drop. And that's exactly what happened. And that's where they then capitalized and were able to, you know, take over and win the game. So, you know, it's one of those things, you know, we say it as coaches a lot, you know, you don't win the game in the first quarter. You know, that was a 40-minute sustained, planned effort. And it came off and it was great.
And to be honest, brilliant being able to watch both teams play at the same time. Like, we had Coops on one screen and I had the women on the other screen. It was fantastic sort of bouncing between the two. But it was a nice hostile crowd in China as well for the game, which always makes it a little bit nicer when you win it. But Bessie, I'm curious, how do you go up against such a dominant post player? When would you change your plan? Because the plan was obviously like pressure the guards as much as you possibly can, make the feed in there difficult, but we're going to play behind the post. At any stage, would you sit there and say, hey, we're not comfortable with this? Because, I mean, she had, what, 42, I think it was. Like, it's a lot of points. But are you okay with that if you still win the game on the other end of it?
Well, it was almost comical. You know, like, she'd catch it and you were just, you know, I'm sure that the staff and everything weren't laughing as it was happening. But, you know, for us, it's like, what do you do? Like, they're doing their best to wall up and it's, you know, she's just a layup drill. You know, so,
and they forced her into some tough shots and stuff like that. And
definitely,
she was, and she's still huge. Like, she can still grab an offensive rebound, even if you do a great job on the box out.
Yeah, we spoke about, you know, do you zone off a little bit more? You know, not necessarily fronting the post, but, you know, sandwiching the post maybe, and some things like that. But they had their plan, and it stuck to it. You know, the thing that was, you know, really in that back into the third quarter, early fourth quarter, was she started stopping short and, like, because she was cooked and they were leaning on her and they were pushing her. And, it, you know, so she had more and more catches on the foul line, whereas early on it was, like, literally you could draw a line. She'd run down the split line and get to the three-point line. She'd just veer straight to the right block, you know. So that it worked. So I don't know if you would change it, you know. Yeah. And then – I'm still unsure. I didn't actually go back to check the box score, but did she foul out or was it her fourth foul and she sat the last 4 minutes of the game?
Yeah.
I can't tell you with any certainty.
Because I thought they were just giving her a quick break. But when she went to the bench, she literally, like, had ice packs on. She was cooked. And I was confused. I thought, you know, maybe it's just a quick blow to get her back on, but they didn't bring her back on. So, yeah. Was it four fouls or?
I'm not too sure, but if it was four fouls, I was expecting her to come back in and bring him home. So, but it also could have been a case where she came out and she's like, I just can't go anymore, which is also a.
They made her move.
Well, that was the look on her face. Yeah. You know, like, and I'll read it out again, like, in the timeouts, they were like ice packs. It was like Jordan flu game, sort of, like, you know, how he was like slumping on the bench. That's, you know, that's how she looked. She looked gassed.
Yeah, but what a phenomenal talent too. Oh. Like, it's how many times do we see the taller players that have no fundamental skill set to go with it? They just relied on being tall. Her shot technique is very nice. Like, it is smooth. It is fluid. It looks like she can get it away. It's not fast, but it doesn't need to be fast yet. It will need to get faster as she obviously moves up the levels, but she's in a position where, like, I'm pretty sure she's still under 17s eligible.
Yeah, I believe she is. So it was only four fouls, Zoe.
Yep.
Yeah, well, there you go. So the plan worked. You know, I don't think she wanted to go back in. Like, she was tapping out. And, you know, I felt we had a similar thing with Rocco, not from a conditioning standpoint, but, you know, someone that is large and skilled, and it was a pleasure to coach, you know, and I spoke about that on a previous pod, but it's unique.
Yep.
You know, it's unique.
Yep. And just when and how you use them as well. Like, you made mention of it, so you don't win it in the first quarter. But the temptation is, when she's racking up points, like, it's going out of fashion in the first quarter, we'll just keep playing her, we'll be fine. But from the Chinese perspective, they had to work out, well, okay, when do we play her? When do we sit her? When can we, like, when do we really need her? And they probably played their card a little early in, you know, we're going to play her a little bit more than we really want to early on in the hope that cracks the game open. But you just saw the tempo in particular. It's and it'd be remiss of us not to talk about Saffron Shields, who was just unbelievable, carrying the ball. Bonnie Dees did a great job defensively. Like, a lot of the time, she was the extra player in on the double that would be digging down from a guard as well. Like, did a fantastic job. Lara Somfy just continues to just be an outstanding athlete that just, again, under 17s eligible in that world. It's a great win for the Gems.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I really hope the basketball community, like, having these conversations, I think, is great about what would you do, this, that, and the other. They're the conversations, I think, that need to be had rather than some of the conversations that are out there at the moment.
Yep, it's completely fair. Moving on, coach shout-outs. Zoe, you got these for this week?
Yeah, I just wanted to shout out, we've spoken about CMC, but I just wanted to shout out my mentor coaches that I had over the 2 days. So for CMC, I have a bit of a structure of four up-and-coming young female coaches, and I pair them with four more experienced mentor assistant coaches. And my four mentor coaches, Ainsley Howard, Sharon Denham, Chloe Hogg, and Mahala Jackson, just did an outstanding job, you know, guiding the younger coaches, but also allowing them to, you know, step out in front and lead their teams and, you know, allow them to sort of fall a little bit where they needed to, but picked them up where they needed to as well. They played the balance really, really well. And one of the things that was great is that now that those young coaches now have, you know, somebody else they can call if they they hit, you know, all the issues we hit as coaches where we think, oh, nah, I'm done with this, in our lower moments. They've now got somebody else to call. There's a genuine connection there between them, and, you know, it wasn't just about the knowledge that they were able to impart. It was, you know, the support they gave them, the confidence they gave them. So, yeah, it was unreal, and I was really, really proud of all of the coaches, but just really impressed with the mentor coaches, and yeah, just want a massive thank you to them and giving up their time to help the next crop of coaches through.
Mentor coaches really is the untapped like gold for mine. Like, we do need to do more work having coaches with mentor coaches. Like, Bestie, I know you still talk to a lot of your mentors that you've had as you were coming through. Like, you're in a high performance role, but you still tap into them over the course. Like, it's just such a valuable part of coaching to know that there is someone you can call. And even if it's just a, hey, I just need a different opinion, can you give me something that I'm maybe not seeing? Give me your opinion on those types of things. It's just such a valuable part of the coaching development experience that we probably haven't really got right yet, I'd suggest. But we can. That's the good part.
Yeah, it's difficult because there's always this, I guess, stigma, maybe, if that's the word, that they're going to try and take over, or, you know, they actually want the job for themselves or whatever it might be. So finding the person with the skills is important, but then also finding the person that is at the appropriate point in their journey to want to do that is hard, really hard. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And even just asking someone, like, it's a really awkward conversation, like, hey, can you mentor me? And people almost don't know how to react to that. Like, it's, am I taken aback by it? Do I just jump in boots and all? Like, it's a really, I don't think you can force the relationship. It almost has to happen organically. I mean, you obviously have forced it to a degree, Zoe, with how you structure it. But it is one of those ones that I think you kind of almost have to put two people in the same realm as each other and just sort of say, hey, let's just see if this works. Like, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I've actually had a conversation, like, officially with the people that I would consider my mentor coaches, but we just talk a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so
that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's the informal stuff that I think is actually the best stuff.
But I would describe them as that, but it hasn't actually been a, you know,
an official, like,
yeah, hey, I don't know.
You've what been is anointed.
It? Yeah, is there a ceremony or something? What am I meant to give them?
No medals involved.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting part of it too, that I would encourage coaches out there that are looking to further their own development, go and grab a mentor coach. Now, whether it be, and sometimes half the battle is the intimidation factor of, you know, I don't know that I can walk up to someone and just have this conversation that I may or may not know. How do I do that? Those types of things. I get that. Ask. Like, coaches are givers by nature. I don't know too many that have just sort of said, hey, no, I'm not doing this, I'm out. And even if it's just as simple as, look, can I just grab you know, half an hour of your time once every 6 months or something like that, that can be enough to just continue to make the wheels move.
Yeah. Creating supportive, especially for all coaches, definitely for all coaches, absolutely vital for female coaches that they have a community and a network and a support base. And an example of how that worked for us over the last 2 days was there was one of the games where it actually ended in a draw, but it was there was a few seconds to go. I can't remember how many seconds, but and I was sort of standing there watching, and I'm, you know, because I talk to myself during games, and I'm like, time out, time out, time out.
This happened. I was standing yeah. behind her.
and but I would never yell out that or anything like that. It was just more like it got it out of my system. But and then I saw the young coach, she's 17, right? She turns and looks at her mentor coach and gestures like, time out. And her mentor coach says, yes. And then she calls it. And it was like, she knew what to call. She knew she was supposed to call a timeout. She just needed that backup and that confidence from someone. So the next time that situation comes around, she's not going to need somebody there. She knows that she should. That's the right call to make. So it's just it's so important. It's so
a safety net.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
Like yeah.
That's fantastic. All right, we'll jump into what we're actually supposed to talk about on this pod, which is now half an hour in, so this could go for a little while as it turns out.
It's been great.
Yeah, it's been just like catch up before we actually have to go and do something. What we're going to look at is just some counterpoints to opinions that we've usually had on the podcast. So it's anyone that's listened for a lengthy period of time would have a pretty rough idea on what we believe, why we believe things and all that sort of stuff. There's a reason we've got to thinking that way in particular, but it's not that we're completely closed off to the other side of the opinion or the argument, I suppose. So we'll start with the first one, which is teaching players to win over teaching development. And when we look at it from a team perspective, we're all competitive people. We all like to win games. Our kids like to win games. Our parents expect us to win games, as we keep finding out. It is a difficult spot to be in when how do you make the right ethical decision, so to speak, as a coach to sit there and say, actually, this is a teachable moment. I'm going to sacrifice a win here in the hope that this will teach them about whether it be time and score, whether it be what offense to run at what time, whether it be how to change up out of a defense, whatever the case may be. The winning over development argument is one that has been going on since the dawn of basketball and will continue to move on. And it is a difficult, ethical one to have, I find, for a lot of coaches that sit there and say, look, I'm doing everything the right way. I'm doing everything that everyone's telling me to do, which is play my kids equal minutes, give them opportunities, you know, get out of their way a little bit and let them kind of work their own stuff out. But I keep losing games to people that value winning over developing, and I see the end, the other end, they don't play their kids or they sit in a zone for 32 minutes or whatever the case may be. Can you give me the argument for winning over developing, Zoe?
I hate this pod already.
We're only 30 minutes in. We're good.
Winning is a skill. It is something you need to learn how to do. It is also being able to have athletes recognize when it is time to step up. I mean, we spoke about it before. So that they do need to recognize that, hey, we need this particular shot. That's my my go-to. I'm going to step up and hit this shot or whatever it is. So it is a skill. It is something that that we do need to work on. I'm finding this really hard. Also, though, it does also make kids feel good. So, you know, winning is fun. I mean, there is the argument, do you hate losing more than you like winning? Often it's more you just hate losing more. But winning is fun, and you find that, you know, things can run a bit smoother when you're winning. It's hard for people to complain, I guess, when wins are happening. It won't stop them, but it's hard for them to complain. So it can be a bit of a band-aid for other things that might not be going so well. And yeah, makes kids, and it makes, I suppose, you feel good as a coach to win as well. You are putting in a lot of time and a lot of effort. So winning is, again, fun. But yeah, I would just say it's a skill set and makes it's a band-aid.
Yep. What about you, Bestie?
Hard to put much more on top of that. I will say, you know, and this is a bit, you know, not in the spirit of this pod, but if you are if you are developing correctly, you'll win anyway.
Eventually, at least.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, I think for coaches, it's important to understand, you know, if you want to progress, particularly through our pathway and maybe, you know, on what wins are valued, you know, because I think it's like winning is important, like Zoe said, but if you get to the VC Grand Final and if you get to the Classic Grand Final or whatever it might be, we would be probably a little bit more inclined to be impressed with winning the big game as opposed to winning all your games, because we know in juniors the development piece is important. But if you get there, you know, like then that's – yeah, they coach a really good game in pressure, like that type of thing. What do they do in the CMC when it's, you know, the last 5 minutes and it is winning time? Like we're probably more – well, I'm probably more, I guess, impressed by that than what I would be just running back – you know, obviously running back into a press for the whole season. You know, but what are you going to do to win that game? Because if you do want to coach for us, there's going to be that quarterfinal or there's going to be that semifinal, you know. So that's, yeah, I don't know. I'm probably gone off the tracks a little bit.
No. I think you're on the money, because it is a difficult one to really quantify, like what is winning effectively. Well, winning is also developing your kids. Like that really is a different sort of a win. It's not scoreboard related necessarily, but it is also an element of, well, do you look at a team that is really successful, but their kids haven't improved, but just the sum of the parts makes them a successful team because they are good? Or have you developed two or three athletes within your group that have gone from being good players to great players? Well, that's probably the bigger win. Like they're going to be the ones that really progress through the age groups. And I think we've all had it where we've seen really dominant teams in 12s and 14s that aren't dominant teams in 16s and 18s. It's like, yeah, well, they were just early developers in that sort of world in 12s and 14s.
Or played into deficiencies.
Yeah, those types of things. Like it can certainly be a thing for sure, but it is really hard to manage the both. And I think, I mean, I'll speak for both of you here and you can tell me if I'm wrong. You would probably get more out of watching a coach at training than you would during a game, with how they teach, what they teach, when they intervene, those types of things. That would probably tell you a little bit more about them as a coach than watching them coach a team that just presses or zones for an entire game to get a win.
Yeah, I think that the reason for that though is we're both development minded coaches. Yeah, so true. You know, that's where a lot of that or a lot more of that happens. But also, you know, we spoke about it last week about Maureen Johannes and you know, how she used to throw all those crazy, like what was perceived crazy passes behind the back, you know, hook passes, all this sort of stuff. And there were a lot of turnovers young, but her coaches continued to support her with it. And now she's one of the most fun passers to watch in international basketball. So, you know, it is a combination, because it's one thing to teach something in a safe environment and be okay with errors and things in training or in practice. But when you get into the game, can you, you know, does the win take away from allowing those things to happen? That's where the real, you're going to see the real transfer and the real ability to keep going with it if based on your response to something that happens.
There's going to have to be a part three because I'm going again. Right. So a while ago on a podcast, I said, would you ever take employment without knowing the KPIs or the position description, right? And a lot of coaches do that. They take a team without knowing what it is. So once again, I think that's something more coaches should be inquisitive about when they're asked to coach. You know, what is success? What do you actually want from me? You know, those types of things. And, you know, there's only one first team in each age group. So not everyone's going to get one. And some of my most valuable coaches when I was in DOC roles was the guy that took the all bottom age group. And we had those conversations around, you know, how many of your players are transitioning into the ones next year? You know, that type of stuff. So that is winning, like you spoke about, Rob. So, yeah, that's important, knowing what is actually expected. You know, and I think our coaches knew that through CMC. Yep. You know, like we, you know, there's obviously a little bit of banter if you lose the close one or whatever, but it's, did the kids get better? You know, where are they now? Sort of question.
Yep. I think there's a lot of value in that. All right, Bessie, we'll go to you first on this one. Give me the case against zones being banned in 12s and 14s.
So saying that we should have them.
Yep. Or they can be used.
You know, I'm not 100% against them being used in 14s. I think we spoke about this before, saying that there should be some sort of like time limit on it or like whatever. There was a, you've got a zone card that you could play or something. Do you remember us talking about that?
We're talking about, I think you could do it for the first half maybe.
Something like that, right? Yeah. 12s, I'm against it. So that'll be really hard for me to argue with that. Maybe it's possible if you do what a lot of tournaments do and you play like 5 games in a day, maybe you can have one zone game or something like that. That's really the only thing I could say for under 12s. But I do think it would be beneficial to be able to play some zone maybe in the back end of under 14s, because there's a lot of kids that they then jump into 15s, which is really under 16s, and every coach is like, we can do this now, so we're going to do it. You know, and I think particularly in the Victorian system, you see a lot of it in grading, because it's like, you know, I can just, you know,
jag one early.
Pull the ripcord. This is what we're doing. So, you know, and under 15s, national teams now, they're going to go up and see, you know, they'll see some zones. That's the only thing. It's probably more for what they're about to see, not necessarily for winning games in 14s, I think would be my argument for it. It's like, when do we start preparing them for this? Because we know it's coming. So probably 14s, I think there's more of an argument than 12s.
Maybe it could be something along the lines of after the split in VC, now you're allowed to zone for the back half of that under 14s. Like we're talking VC in particular. Obviously, teams have qualified for clubs at that stage, because you'd hate to be the team that plays zone for the entire first half of the season, qualifies for clubs, then gets to clubs and can't zone. It's that kind of thing. So maybe it is something to revisit and look at, well, okay, can there be some form of zone? Because I think by the time, looking at the size of some of those kids that were running around at CMC, they're not tiny kids. Like, they can probably deal with a zone now because they can make skip passes, they can have some post play, they can shoot from the perimeter.
We had one kid make 7 threes in a game at CMC.
Yeah, well, you're not zoning him, are you?
Yeah. And that was a long line. So the courts in Bendigo, those three courts, they don't have the under 14 line. So there's some skill there to do it. I guess that's the argument. You know, we're trying to play the devil's advocate here.
Yep.
If you're going to do it, it needs to be with the mindset of preparing them for what's coming the next year, because that's often what we talk about. We are preparing you for the next thing.
Yep.
Whereas we don't really get to do that in 14s, except for the understanding that solid offensive foundations will help you against a zone anyway.
Yep, makes sense. Zoe, what about you?
This is tough for me. So I was the one that kicked off the push for the zone bans in under 12s. So I'm the same as Bestie. Under 12s, I wanted it banned. We did it for under 12s and then for a year, and it was quite successful. And then it just changed to 14s as well. I think the reason to be able to do it, similar to Bestie, would be just for when they go off to nationals and things as under 16s, to have had more experience playing against a zone. But there's a million reasons why not as well. It's hard. I agree, after the split, we should be able to have some in 14s, sorry, we should be able to have some access to zone, whether it be the first half or something like that. We should be able to say you can zone, you know, use zones for what they are, use them sparingly, use them as change-ups, use them as that, and trust that everyone will do it. But unfortunately, we can only move as fast as our slowest person. So we can't trust that everybody's going to do it. And
you are the weakest link.
Yeah. But because, again, similar to the last question though, the win starts to take over.
Yeah.
Zones will get you wins. So if we're saying winning over development, then yeah, zone. So that's a reason to zone, you know, because it will get you wins, especially in 12s, in lower grades in under 14s as well. Under 14s, you know, like you said, when you have that split and you've got kids that can stick 7 threes in a game and stuff like that, well then, yeah, like, you know, start to sprinkle that in a bit. But yeah, unfortunately, we can't rely on that to be used the way that it should be used.
Yeah, I've got another one as well. So I think in our environment in Victoria and mostly Australia, you get two practices, right? So at that age, what do you need to prioritize? Yeah. So obviously that, you know, zone offense probably becomes the lowest on the totem pole, and that's why we say no zone. However, if it was a different environment, say you're in an academy in Europe or something like that, and you're with the coach every day, yeah, and that is your sport commitments solely, you're not playing multiples or you're not playing for 3 or 4 different people, whatever it might be, there's probably more of an argument for it, because 100%. You can say, you know, all right, we're going to budget, you know, one of our practices to zone offense, and it's not really going to hurt us. Everybody remembers, well, most people should remember that group that came out from Europe and played in the under 14s. They did really well over here until they came up against a zone press, and the coach was like, well, give me one practice and I'll deal with that, you know. But they said that they really only did a team offensive session once a week. You know, they practiced 5 or 6 times a week, but they only did that once a week. They did, you know, skill development, small-sided games, like whatever it might be for the other stuff. So you could very easily work in, you know, that scenario, and that could work.
Yep. Yeah, and that was the whole reason for the push to bring in the ban in the first place, is you were having to allocate so much time to a zone offense rather than passing, dribbling, shooting, defending. You know, like the fundamental basics at that formative age was being spent on run here, lift there, pass there, you know, that sort of stuff. Or so much time was being budgeted to shot technique, and then the only shot they could get was outside the three-point line under 12s. Like it, and back then it was size sixes being used. So, yeah, it was – it's if I completely agree with Bestie. If you have them every day in an academy style, yeah, bring it back. No problem. But we are too time poor to be budgeting so much or what would be required to at that age to get them to be able to run a zone offense effectively. To do that, you've then got to bypass all the other things, that skill sets that are so important.
Well, and part of it too is, if you're teaching like an active, disruptive type of zone, I'm here for it. Like I'm certainly good with that. It's the carnival walk back 2-3, nobody moves, those types of zones.
Well, and the big kid that stands in the paint that doesn't move. We're supposed to be saying 4 zones.
No, I understand that. But to give people some perspective on this as well, like we do get a lot of zone complaints coming in from the VJBL on that. It usually ends up with me at various stages. Look, what's your opinion on it? And a lot of the times it isn't a zone. There are 4 kids matching up and there's just one kid that sits at the charge circle and doesn't really follow any cutters or move or show any interest in it. But people are now starting to try and put a zone complaint in to get a result overturned. So it's now starting to focus in more on the, can we get a win out of this rather than are we developing players the right way? So,
but also if you're one of the coaches that are sitting your big there and having everybody else match up, do better.
Well, exactly right. And that's the difficult part of it, is that I think we all acknowledge what is probably the right way to go about doing this, and the right way would probably be to have no ban on zones in there. But it is one of those areas too where if you looked at the game internationally, there's not a lot of zone being played internationally. Like there is some for sure, but there's not a lot. It's more a case of are you accountable to keep the ball in front of you on the perimeter? And if you've got three layers of help behind you, well, there's probably not that level of accountability for it either.
And yeah, it was
great. Oh, sorry,
yeah.
just real quick on the zone complaints and stuff. Yes, zone complaints come in, but over the amount of games that are being played on a Friday night, it's nothing. So the majority of coaches are doing the right thing.
This is me having a whinge. Yeah. This is nothing else.
No, but we very much appreciate that because from us, from a high-performance perspective, if you're not doing the right thing in those formative ages, those kids don't make it through to us. So because of that, it's fantastic and keep it up.
Bestie?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, we didn't see much zone at Schweitzer. You know, the Crocs, they did some zone, like end out, I think, and maybe even side out was it?
Well.
Yeah, so it's more like special situation, disruption type stuff. But, yeah, if we had more time with them, that's the way we could say we could have zones.
Yep, absolutely. On to the next one. The case for structured zone presses, Zoe. So we'll just extend this a little further up the floor.
So up the floor?
Yep.
As in that's all you run?
Yeah.
Got a headache.
Yeah.
Yes. What is this going to be? You made me think of stuff I hate talking about.
I guess you are you increased decision making against pressure. So because it's constant, offense is having to find the open player, move the ball safely. And probably have to make passes off the dribble. From an actual you're the defender's point of view, the kids at the front will have a ripper time. Third line maybe as well.
Because they don't have to do anything.
No, well, they get the steals. They get the steals at the half. The kid at the back, not so much.
The kids at the front will have a ripper time. And it will be reflected in the box score.
Yeah. They'll learn to play with sort of intensity because you have to. They'll get fit because you have to. Again, the first three players.
They'll be at the game.
Yeah. They'll be there, yeah.
They'll win more often. That'll make them happier.
Yeah, they'll win more often. Yeah. And again, that's the thing, right? Like the very first question, if you want to put the win ahead of the development, then yeah, press, you'll get a win.
You can make the argument that you're making the opposition team better because they're having to deal with high-pressure situations.
Well, that was Zoe's first point. Yeah. It's like, so
I think that's the best point.
Yeah.
The point is you're helping the other team. Yeah, you're helping the other team. you're a double agent. You know, like, don't do it, people. Like, grow up.
it's a tough one, though. Like, it's... And similar with the zones, though, I'm actually okay with teams using structured presses and all that sort of stuff. I'm not okay with it for 32 minutes or 40 minutes or whatever we use.
We spoke about it after the classic. You know, someone running back into the zone on the tip. You know, someone, you know, we did some man pressing, not zone pressing, but we did man pressing after a foul shot at CMC. Yep. You know, like it was, we'd face guard the point guard with the person guarding the inbound and we'd call that face 40 or pack 40. So time... You know, like the time to do it is important, but yeah, everybody knows it's just not the right thing to do, and it has a huge effect in low age groups. As you get older, they can just throw it over the top of it, you know, or, you know, if they break it, it's actually like, we're going to go get a layup now. So it really is a winning-based decision, I think. I've had a lot of people ask me, you know, how did you guys work on your press break if you didn't zone press? Yeah, you know, argument. So like that is probably an argument for it. So if you do it a little bit, then that way you can learn to play against it. Yep. So like we don't 2-3 zone with my youth league team, but we obviously have to have zone offense for 2-3 zone. So naturally through practice we've gotten better at our 2-3 zone because I've had to say to them some things like, well, you've actually got to get out to that and wait for the top to you know bump you down sort of thing. So even though you don't want to spend that much time on it, But my response to that question has always been, well, it challenges you as a coach. We would come up with some passing games and divide the court into quadrants and things like that. But I think that's probably the main benefit to doing a zone press, if we're saying, yes, we should zone press, is to learn how to play against it in practice for when you do come against that idiot that is doing it all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. I'm saying all the time.
Yeah, well, no, there was I won't name the club, but a while ago, there was a club that in under 12s, they would press entire game, the entire game, and they won everything. And then as those kids started to progress.
Bestie wasn't in charge of this club, was it? Just making sure.
No, he definitely wasn't. Just making sure. No, it was on the, it was a fair way away from Bestie. But then as those kids got older, you know, and everyone's like, oh, this team, they're amazing, they're this, they're that. Those kids started to not feature in even development programs because they had zero understanding of team defense, how to stay in front of the ball, how to just not gamble or jump lanes or things like that. And a lot of kids, and I'm talking about the kid that was always at the back line, quit. So it was, it was interesting to watch how that played out. They did it for a couple of years and then there was some personnel change throughout the club and now it's changed, which is good. But you just saw how much it put the athletes behind, which was really sad.
Yeah, we've gone off topic again.
We've brought it back to why.
It's okay. You know, talking split, you know, either you're drinking the Kool-Aid or you're not, guys. Come on, right?
And it must be lime or red.
Yeah, right? So we are not saying zone pressing is bad.
No,
not at all.
We are saying zone pressing all the time is bad.
Yeah. Yep.
And it's the same argument with zoning. How much time do you want to spend on coaching your press break?
Preferably none. A necessary evil is the byproduct. Look,
I'll be honest. This is what I, you know, pitched to the board at Casey before I took the job there, saying club wide press break, so we don't have to reteach it each year.
Mm.
You know, you're only teaching the new kids. The kids that have been in the program for a few years know it. They can help coach the other kids. And wow, all of a sudden we start to not trip up in grading when someone slams that press on you, and then all of a sudden you got more teams grading for high levels. So. That's a real live case study, I guess, for having to not spend as much time on it and still have some results because it was a club. Like every age group, every gender had to run the same press break. So then it became less and less of an issue as they went through the age groups.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. All right, we're on to the next one. Skills trainers, Bestie. Give me the case for.
Why are you going to me for that? We had that whole list last time. Look, I used to be a skills trainer.
Yeah.
You know, like, and to be honest, we somewhat still are. You know, when we, you know, my Monday nights, they're all skills-based sessions. So the case for them is complementary, I think, is probably the most important thing to say. And we've had another pod before around, you know, how to pick one. You know, if you're going to go with one around, you know, making sure they're qualified, insured, connected to the level that you want them to go, like all those types of things. So go back and listen to that episode. I came in with a list. I was prepared.
You were.
But they've got to be complementary. So that can help. You know, if there's someone that has a glaring issue holding them back from the next level, whether it's shot mechanics or whatever it might be, so the case for them is when it's complementary and it's consultive, if that's is that the right word?
Consultative.
Consultative, yeah. Right. Well,
I know where you're going with it.
Synergy, right?
There you go.
So if we are working, you know, those coaches are working with their other coaches around, hey, what do you see? What do you need them to see? What do you need them to improve on? How can I help with this? You know, that if that's the case, all for it, because gyms are hard to get into, you know, particularly kids. It's not so much everyone plays for the association that's 5 minutes down the road from them now. Like that's a whole nother issue, but there's a lot of people that are in the car traveling. So some of that, I guess, auxiliary work that needs to be done can be done through a skills trainer, right? So that's when I think it can work. If it's complementary, if it's, you know, in conjunction with what their team coaches need from them. And that was one of my biggest gripes, once again, when I was at Casey. I would say, you know, you and even in our programs here, it's like, yeah, you're doing this academy and you're telling us this is why you should be in our program or make a state team or whatever it might be. And my argument always came back to, well, why hasn't that person ever once reached out to us and said, well, what do you need from them? You know, and we would welcome that. You know it's a thing that kids are going to do. We would welcome that. And, you know, well, I'm going down it again. There's a difference between a workout guy and a skills trainer too. Like, there's a lot of skills trainers that, well, workout guys that call themselves skills trainers, and they just roll the same workout out regardless of who's doing it. So, you know, there's a bit of that. But it can help because of the environment that we're in where everything is very team-centric. We've only got, you know, 3 hours or 4 hours maximum a week in a practice for your team. And if we're spending, you know, half of that on our zone press, our zone offense, you know, we're going to need that.
And shell drill, which has to be in every team shell training drill, session
ball
as well.
Screen D, all that, yeah. So I think that's where it can work.
Yep. Yeah, there's a good case for it there.
I think it, other than like, because Bessie's hit the nail on the head, absolutely spot on.
But all right, I think moving on.
I guess another positive is the, like, having that work ethic of, you know, wanting to get better and wanting to be on court more than you are and that you're able to be throughout clubland or whatever it is. I think that's a good thing. The thing I would counter to it is, instead of spending that time, you know, working the same muscles, putting the same pressure on the same joints, go S&C, go, you know, swim, go do something else that complements, again, like Bestie was saying, something else that use that time a little bit more effectively rather than loading up even more on things that if your skills trainer isn't going to consult with where you want to go to, it's not really then giving you anything other than just extra pressure and extra load.
Yeah, and I think you've both nailed that completely. There is certainly a place for it. In particular, if you've missed out on a program or something like that and it's like, well, how am I ever going to get back in there if I'm now doing less work than the people that are in the program, I need to go and find a way to get more reps, more coaching, whatever the case may be.
Yep.
Great. Like, credit to you for going and doing it. Find someone that cares, that doesn't just treat you as another number, that, hey, you know, we've already got six people in this session. Oh, we'll just add one more in seven. Well, how much care and coaching do you think you're going to get when you're one in seven kids at a session? Probably not much, and you are getting the cut and paste workout in that sort of situation. So do your homework on it, because I think there are plenty of people out there that are actually really good in this space that are great trainers. Don't go to the person with the most Instagram likes or the most followers. They're not usually the best trainers. They're just great marketing people.
Well, and that will use you to get them more money. Yeah, exactly. You know, right. So it's you know, if you miss out on something and you go to this skill trainer or you're with a skills trainer and you miss out on something, and the first thing they say is that, you know, the people making decisions don't know what they're doing, they're idiots, they're this, they're that, that's a problem. That's a red flag for me. Because to me, again, that's they're selling you something that may not exist, but they're doing it so they can make money. So yeah, I'd just be a little careful about it. And if people are looking to try and get skills trainers or something like that, you know, and want to know, you know, thoughts on it, get in contact with us and we'll look to help you out. Like there's some that we think are actually really good. But yeah, it's
there's also plenty of other people with a platform just to make money, and that's really all they're interested in.
Yeah.
That's the danger.
I don't have an issue with people making money either. Please, like, don't get me wrong.
But I think use the player.
The player is not the product, and the aim should always be one, being truthful with them, and two, doing what's best for them rather than doing what's best for you.
Yeah, you've got to go into it knowing exactly what you want out of it. Not just, oh, I should be doing this because it's, you know,
it's the more is better.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
More is better.
Well, and what an interesting segue you just hit us with there, bestie. Workload. Give us the case, Zoe, that workload is not actually a thing and they should be able to train more often, do more stuff, everything under the sun. Geez, I can see the cogs ticking in the head at the moment and she searches for an answer.
Well, no, because it's tough, because I think there was a bit of a time there where I think we backed too far off and ended up hurting more. I have no data on this. This is just a thought.
Eye test.
Yeah, something that I believe through my experience is that, you know, working them more younger can actually be helpful in a way, mostly because when, you know, the people of our age were young, we didn't have screens or anything to distract us. So we were outside, we were running around, we were, you know, jumping on trampolines and breaking arms because they didn't have cages. You know,
get caught in the springs.
Get caught in the springs. Man. Nothing you is more that. Scary Jeez. Than the earth hurtling towards you as you've fallen off the trampoline. But
getting burned by the spring too. Like you caught one of those on a sunny day. Like that was like a tattoo almost.
Yeah,
like
you'd have to put your sunny boy on it.
Put the water. Yeah. but, you know, rollerblading, skateboarding, you know, all these other things that that we used to do. Now, what was riding bikes was a big one. What we were actually doing was building a base level of fitness. The kids aren't doing as much of that now, and so they don't have that base level of fitness. So then when the load does come on, they break. So maybe from a younger perspective, a younger age group, adding a bit more workload. Obviously, I don't think it should be on court. I think it should be more cross training, different types of things, allowing them to play other sports and stuff like that might be beneficial to then resilience in joints and ligaments and muscles. But then, yeah, obviously as they get older and things start to be a little bit more breaky. I can't really find a reason for that, but maybe younger.
Yeah, it's a difficult one because our kids also don't look the same as they did 30 years ago. Like our kids, a 7'3" girl that just played for China that's still eligible for under 17s, like they aren't lying around everywhere, it'd be fair to say. So I would anticipate that the Chinese Basketball Association has put a lot of work into managing her load, what that would look like, how they would make it so that she's not going to break, those types of things as well. That's a dangerous part. Like we don't have those, or we didn't have those sorts of kids back then either. So there's got to be an element too of, we got to build some resilience, I suppose, in our kids and a base level of fitness is exactly what you're talking about. Does it need to look like penalties at practice where you just turn, I still remember one of my under 14 training sessions where I turned up. I was playing at this day. I got to qualify that. I was not the 14s coach. Turned up, our coach was on the phone and he's like, hey, I just got to finish up this phone call. And instead of going inside to the gym to shoot for until that had finished, he's like, just run 14 laps of the school. And, you know, by that stage, I should be done and you can come back in and train. And it's like, what the hell is this? Like,
how far away did you live from there?
If I just walked home, it'd probably be the equivalent of the 14 laps.
Yeah, I'd have just walked home.
Yeah. 12-year-old Rob, not a great decision maker, it turns out. Not totally dissimilar to 42-year-old Rob. But it's one of those areas too where you've got to be careful as to, are we putting kids too much in cotton wool by saying, have this session off, don't do this, don't do that, when they could be on court more?
Yeah. Probably an unpopular opinion. Kids should be doing more physical activity in primary school.
Yep.
You know, like we see those old, you know, high school videos in America where like everyone's like, you know, it's like military training type stuff. Bring it back. That's what I say. that's honestly what I think. Bring it back. You know, it's not safe. You know, like we used to ride our bikes all over town, you know, do like, and I even remember, you know, my parents were building a house in Berwick. And I was like, climbing through these double story house frames, you know, like, do you know what I mean? Like, do, like on a building.
Balancing yeah. over yeah. it like you were a gymnast.
On a building site, you know, like, at, you know, so, but there's also, so there's that, but it's also, there's a lot of weirdos out there right now. There's crime and there's all this type of stuff, you know. Would you be, we've even had this conversation with it, my family. We've got a young three-year-old and our estate has all of these beautiful parks. Now, I'm not saying let your three-year-old go to the park by themselves, but at an age where I would have gone to the park by myself, I'm probably not going to be comfortable to send Skylar to the park by herself, you know, because the world is different is what I'm getting at. So we need to have more of that stuff through school. I think more of that. So then they have that base level of mobility, strength, you know, you're born with it. You know, you see kids like they have like functional movement, like Skylar, she's strong, man. She can pull herself up. She can balance her, you know, all that stuff. So, and it's proportionate to her body weight and, you know, muscle mass and all that right now. But if she stops doing things, it's, you know, it's going to deteriorate and go the other way. So that's important. And I think, yeah, bring it back. Bring back the PE, you know, circuit stuff in school. Like more of that, less, you know, other stuff. I'm not going to say what the other stuff might need to be. But I think it's important because the health, the mental health benefits, the physical health benefits, the social skills, like all of that is important. But we've had a few presentations at the COE around load the last few camps. And load, my takeaway from those is load isn't bad. Load's not bad.
Yep.
It's spikes.
Yeah, fluctuation of loads.
Is the issue. So it's big, you know, increases in spike, in load, sorry, and then big decreases in load, and that's where the changes in it all is where the injuries come from. So it's, you know, if athletes are conditioned to two or three practices a week and then their game, but then all of a sudden they get slammed into five games in one day school tournament, and then the next week, you know, then they do nothing, and then the next week they got another tournament of some sort. And, you know, even we just did it. You know, like we just did it with the CMC kids, you know. We did it in the school holidays because now they don't have rep and they don't have rep practice and that stuff. So we try to manage that where as best possible. But that's been my biggest takeaway. Load is not bad. It's the spikes and changes in load. But the difficulty is, once again, because everyone is wearing so many different hats and it's, you know, pulled in so many different directions.
And again, it's the same thing we were talking about before. It's also load of all the same thing. You know, like it's instead of picking up another team to play for or another training to get or so, go lift. Go do something else that's using different muscles, different joints.
Gymnastics, karate, something. Judo, like any right. of those would be fantastic.
You know what? Dance. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I've been the biggest advocate for kids being involved in some sort of dance, from footwork to core to body movement. I think it's amazing.
Timing.
Yeah.
Like the whole finding a beat on certain
strength,
things.
Strength, yep. All of it. Yeah, I think if you want to do something else, go do that. But anyway, it's about, I think, also spreading that load across different things rather than just I'm going to train, you know, 8 hours a day on court, the same thing. Well, yeah, of course you're going to break down.
Yeah. Stress fracture's coming.
Definitely, you know, and this is where like going and climbing in that house, you know, like or you know,
or riding a bike, like
whatever,
you know,
it might
those
be.
Sort of things.
Yeah. All I can think of when you said that was about the scene in The Other Guys, you know, where he can dance. Is like, yeah, I learned to do that sarcastically. You
know? I went straight to Gina Lovetti in Brooklyn.
Oh, night. Right. Okay. Yeah. And he just crushes it, you know. Yeah.
All right. Last one. Give me the case for specializing in a position early on, bestie. So just say you've got the tall kid, for argument's sake.
Can we just quantify though? Is the tall kid, is it genuine tall?
Yeah, taller than their age group.
Okay. So taller maybe not genuine taller.
Well, maybe not, okay. Potentially. But teaching, and this, like, I've got a real weird theory on this, and I'll stick with me, everyone. Dirk Nowitzki has screwed up basketball for everyone because everyone feels like they can be a 7 foot tall guard wing that can move gracefully and stick from the perimeter and those types of things. So everyone has got this thing in their mind that, oh, we get a tall kid, we're not going to teach them to play in the post at all. We're going to try and make them into a guard instead. Give me the case, bestie.
That we should do that.
Yeah.
First of all, I love Dirk Nowitzki. He's like one of my favorite players.
Looks same.
Yeah.
It's somewhat facetious.
You know, there was some guys before him too, though, like Detlef Schrempf, Tony Kukoc, those guys, right? Yep. So the case for it. Well, because winning's important.
Full circle.
That's the case for it. You know, it everything's coming back to how much time can you budget. So if you had the kids more often, then maybe you could say, you know, we're going to go down, you know, similar to education where you're doing like a general degree, but it's this track.
Stream, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So like you could maybe do that. I don't know. The way the game's played now, everyone's going to be able to do everything. You know, I post guards a lot.
Yep.
You know, we post them up. So they need to learn that stuff because it's always going to be, you know, the big kid that we're putting them as a post. And I think, you know, we've got an example right now with Charles Webb. You know, he was probably the best big at under 16 nationals. He, you know, got an ADC or NPC, sorry, national camp out of that. And then he, you know, was a good backup center this year at 18 nationals as a bottom age. But he's probably going to need to be a wing. So we've had some conversations with him around, you know, state teams, you probably are a post. But, you know, so now he's doing both. Like, we have him on both streams, if you want to call that. He does some of the wing stuff. He does some of the post stuff. So the case for it is really only around winning, I think.
Yep. You any difference, though?
Time and experience in a position, maybe. Like, you start to get comfortable with play. Because, as Bestie said, really, when we talk about this, we're talking about putting him big inside, like a bigger player inside. Flip it though. Like,
go point guards. Like, is there any point in teaching them to only be a point guard if they're the smallest kid on the team at that point in time in under 12s or 14s? Or is there any benefit in saying, hey, actually, I have seen your older brother or sister who actually shot up once they hit 16 years old. Maybe we are going to teach you some of the, you know, the post side of the game, so to speak.
I think if that was the case, the smallest player in the team and there's sort of no signs of growth, like the feet are small, all that, then I would stick with them on the perimeter, mostly because I think you can then transfer that. I think it's probably easily transferable into the paint if they were to get bigger. And then you might, or you're lucky to end up with a Dirk or something like that. So, yeah, I think from a big though, because we see it more in bigs. We see it more in players that are, you know, early growth. They get lumped in the paint. Everybody else catches up or overtakes. And then there's no, not future, but like, yeah, you know, it's hard. It's limited. Game, yeah. So the advantage for it is they're used to physicality earlier. They're used to playing in that position and what is expected of them. They're used to running baseline to baseline.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yep. Especially if they're in a structured press too.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
They're used to being like rebounding.
Yeah, yep. Like all that's that sort one. Of stuff. Yep. So
we're really clutching at straws.
Yeah. But I still I feel itchy. I don't like it.
Need to go home and have a shower. Yeah. I just like feel argumentative for the sake of it. And look, to be fair, we probably haven't convinced ourselves on any of these to flip our thinking.
Mm.
Like, what it is more we can see the other side of it, but it probably reinforces why we think that way a little more. Like, if we're struggling for reasons to come up for why it's a good thing, that probably tells you that it's not in that sort of space. So it's, yeah, have your opinions on it. That's okay. But, you know, your theory is your theory.
This is the same process as when you go to a coach's clinic, right? Yep. You know, oh, that's good. Or, you know, maybe I should do this different. Or, no, what I'm doing is right. Yep.
trial and error.
Yeah.
But ultimately, it's, you know, you're going to make mistakes. Like I have, like looking through this list in particular, I have zoned in 12s and 14s when we were back allowed to do it. Would I do it now? Probably not. But it is one of those things. Like we've all done stuff on this list that we sort of sit there and say, look, at the time, yes, but right now, no. And that's okay too. So that does wrap us up for this week. We have gone a little bit longer than we normally would. So thank you for sticking with us all the way through on that one. Normally we're not on during school holidays because there's just a mountain of other things going on. But because we came back a little bit later in May, we'll run through effectively with all this and see how we go from there. But if you do have the opportunity to get up to Bendigo for the under-16 Nationals this week, we'd absolutely recommend going and having a little bit of a look at it. It's fantastic to go and see kids compete on a national stage, see what kids from other states look like, those types of things. I think it's a fantastic experience. So whether you're a coach that wants to go and have a little bit of a look at it, we'll obviously be around there. Whether you're a player that wants to go and have a look at the level for where you potentially want to get to, like I know, Zoe, you were talking to your 14s about it's a good idea to go up and have a look at this. If you want to be at this tournament in 2 years' time, come and have a look at it now and get used to it as to what it looks like, because a guard in 14s looks very different to a guard in 16s in that world. So it is a great opportunity for people to go and have a look and, of course, support the Victorian teams as they go about their business. Thank you both for jumping in today, and we'll catch you guys next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform, and don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.